I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. Rethink's first robot was introduced in 2012 and is named Baxter. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. The company went public in 2005 and is headquartered outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. His influential paper, entitled Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, was the inspiration for the Errol Morris documentary of the same name in 1997, in which Dr. Brooks is featured. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
Could you please define what a robot is?
Well, it's a bit like trying to define what art is, but I use the definition the robot is something that senses the world, does some computation, and then decides to act outside the extent of its own body. And I say outside the extent of its own body because I can't stand the thought of a dishwashing machine being a robot. It's not intelligent enough to me.
In 1990, you started your first robot company called iRobot with the intention to produce practical robots. What did you intend to build and to bring out to the market when you first launched the company?
When we first launched the company, we really didn't know. We were a bit naive, more than a bit naive. We knew we had technology to make robots mobile and move around, and we thought, well, everyone's going to like this technology. We'll just start a company. We've got a list of 14 failed business models we went through before we finally got the Roomba in 2002 and the military robots at the same time, and then we went public in 2005. But we had 14 failed business models, which weren't all bad models, just the world wasn't quite ready for some of them.
And what's one example of a model that the world wasn't ready for?
Well, one example was we were doing nuclear power plant inspection robots with the Japanese government, funded by MITI, Ministry of International Trade and Industry, partnered with Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. We did the research. We couldn't get traction for it to be a product until March of 2011, 1 week after the disaster, the Japanese government called iRobot. I was still on the board at that time, and said, please send some robots to Japan.
So instead of launching with a nuclear power plant robot, you launched with a vacuum cleaner. How did that happen?
Well, we had 14 models that we'd looked at, 14 different sorts of products. And all along, people had said, well, I'd like a robot to clean my home. Back in 1990 or 1991 at my lab at MIT, we'd actually built a prototype vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't very good. So eventually, towards the end of the 1990s, where we had learnt to do low-cost manufacturing in China because we'd been doing toy robots for a while, we decided to have another go at building a vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't the first vacuum cleaning robot on the market. The first one was from Electrolux for 2,000 euros in Europe. The key decision we made was we figured out that $200 was a price point that a person could spend without getting their spouse's approval. And so that became the target. The first model was $199.99,
wow.
September 18th, 2002.
You've said before that the robotic revolution parallels the PC revolution. And you've mentioned that when computers started to become more pervasive, they found their ways in toys and games initially before becoming more robust and complicated. Similarly, it seems like the Trojan horse for robots is also in toys and games and vacuums.
Yeah, well, in terms of the number of absolute number of robots, vacuum cleaning robots are more than any other sort of robot by far in the world. Industrial robots that are currently in factories really, to me, are like the mainframes of 30 years ago. Ordinary people can't touch them because they're dangerous. They're very hard to program. And then the PC came along around 1980, and slowly it started to get into offices, and ordinary office workers got to control computation. And the spreadsheet was the first killer app, if you like, where ordinary people could program the computer without having to be programmers. So we're trying to do the similar sort of thing for industrial robots, that ordinary factory workers can learn in minutes how to get it to do new tasks.
just as the PC did not replace the human being and made the human being more ostensibly efficient, your claim with Rethink is that these robots for manufacturing are also assisting the human rather than replacing the human.
Yeah, very much so. I we didn't get rid of office workers. There's lots of office workers around. Now, the tasks that office workers do are very different from the tasks they did 30 years ago. They're much more empowered. And so I see a similar sort of thing with these industrial robots.
Could you walk through some of the other examples of robots that you've built? On the military side, you have these small unmanned ground vehicles that were launched in Afghanistan, for example. What other applications are there of these robots?
We built a lot of custom robots over time. We built some for NASA for experiments with Mars rovers to develop the software for exploring Mars. We built a robot for National Geographic that went into the Great Pyramid and crawled up a little tiny tunnel and cut a hole through to a cavity that was known to be behind there. It was very small, just diameter of the tunnel was just a few inches, so a person couldn't get up there. Then the robot drilled a hole through to see what was inside this cavity, and there was nothing there.
And when you were starting the company and you were seeking venture capital, I mean, this is the nascent stages of the robotics industry. What did that landscape look like?
Well, we didn't actually go after venture capital in 1990. It was totally self-funded, and we would get contracts and ask for half the money up front because we had to float, you know, our payroll. In fact, for the first 8 or 9 years, we never knew that we were going to make payroll at the end of the month. We always did, though.
Hmm.
So it wasn't until 1998 that we started getting venture capital. It was 1998. It was boom times for the internet. I remember the most depressing interchange was Colin, Helen, and I, the three co-founders, on an August afternoon. It was hot. We were sweaty. We go into this one place, and they send out a summer intern, a junior in college, to talk to us. We start telling him what we're doing, and a few minutes in, he looks at us. He says, "You mean you build stuff? No one builds stuff anymore." And that was the end. So, in fact, I went off and started my own venture fund. Got some money from some Swiss pension funds and started a little venture fund with some people I knew called Robotic Ventures. And we did a few investments, but I realized I wasn't very good at being a venture capitalist. We did fine, but, you know, I like pushing the boundaries of things that are almost impossible. And the role of a venture capitalist is to put discipline on the entrepreneur. And I was just the opposite.
And then fast forward to 2008, when you founded Rethink Robotics, you had an easier time raising capital after the success of iRobot. You and Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, were the early investors.
Yeah, when I founded Rethink Robotics, it was very much going to be a venture-based company. I put in some money, and Jeff Bezos' personal investment vehicle put in the other money for the very first Series A1, as we came to call it.
How did you meet Jeff?
Well, I met Jeff a long time ago. I first met him at TED, Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, and he was actually an investor in iRobot before it went public.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robotics, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is professor emeritus at MIT. What was the catalyst for leaving iRobot and going to Rethink? I know that they're focused on different industries, but were there any pivot moments for you?
Well, I had spent, from 1997, I'd been going to China to learn to do low-cost manufacturing. I came to realize that was not going to be sustainable in the long term, that costs were going up in China. Even in the late 90s, if you were doing sewing for toys, that had already moved to Vietnam. So I could see sort of the writing on the wall. I sort of saw that people would want to do more manufacturing back in the United States. Had to be more productive. So I, being a robot guy, my answer was, let's have robots for manufacturing. But then people asked me, why didn't I do it inside iRobot? iRobot was sitting on a lot of cash, well over $100 million at the time I started Rethink Robotics. But if they spend that cash on a long-term development program, it comes off the bottom line. And Wall Street would slap them. So I presented the idea to the board, and as I expected, the board said, no, we can't spend our cash on that. I was under all sorts of agreements with them. They got equity in Rethink Robotics in return for releasing me from some of those agreements and got outside capital to start Rethink Robotics.
Now, Baxter's the name of the robot that you've launched. It costs $22,000. What does Baxter look like?
Well, Baxter's red and black. It's has humanoid form. It has two arms. It has a LCD screen where the face would be, and normally there are eyes animated on that face, and the face always points towards any person who's nearby the robot. And when it's about to reach for something, the eyes glance at where it's about to reach. So if you're working in close proximity to it, it doesn't surprise you with an unexpected motion. It's a bit bigger than a human being. We tried to have it have human reach, but it doesn't have any hips. So we had to make longer arms. So I say it's like an Olympic swimmer is the size of the arms.
You mentioned Baxter's eyes. Are they functional or more social so that people interact with him as if he were a human being?
Yeah, we call Baxter an it because I try to make my robots deliver on any promise they give in their appearance. And I don't know what to promise in terms of gender, so I always call them its. The eyes... There is a camera right above the LCD screen, so it is actually seeing. But the animated eyes are really to give a person an understanding of what the robot is paying attention to.
Just on the subject of humanoid robots, what are the benefits of creating a robot that looks human-like?
Well, actually, when I started Rethink Robotics, I didn't believe we were going to build a humanoid robot. That was not the original intent. But over time, as we talked to many potential customers, a lot of them said they wanted to be able to replace the robot with a person so that if the robot went down, they could just get a person in to take over temporarily so it didn't slow things down. Hmm. So they wanted the reliability of replacing with a person. Now, that led us to build a robot with human-like capabilities in terms of what sort of things it could lift up, 5 pounds at full extension, and how fast it could move.
I've read before that one potential disadvantage of making a robot too human-like is that people might have disproportionate expectations of what it could do. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, I say that if you make your robot look just like Albert Einstein, it better be as smart as Albert Einstein, or otherwise people are going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. So we tried to make Baxter look up, have the appearance of about how smart it is, which is not really very smart.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the roboticist, Dr. Rodney Brooks. We'll hear more from Dr. Brooks coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. I've heard you say before there are four things needed to solve issues with robotics. Do you want to tell what they are?
So I've been telling people in research for a while that there are four aspirational goals. If we make improvement in any of these four, just improvement, the robots will get a lot better. So the first thing is the visual capabilities of a two-year-old child. A two-year-old child, you can show them objects. You can show them a pair of glasses. They'll tell you it's glasses. You can show them a set of keys that they've never seen before. They'll tell you it's a set of keys. So getting to visual object identification capabilities of a two-year-old child. The language capabilities of a four-year-old child. A four-year-old child can understand accents. You don't have to dumb down the grammar. They may not know all the words, but they're learning words at an incredible rate. They understand questions. They understand conditionals. They understand a bunch of stuff at age four. At age six, the manual dexterity of a six-year-old child. A six-year-old child can tie shoelaces. A six-year-old child can do any task that is asked of a Chinese factory worker. They have that dexterity. They may not be able to play Chopin on the piano, but they've got the dexterity to do any sort of cooking task, any sort of task in the house. if they're so inclined. And the last one is the social understanding of an 8-year-old child. It's really a 9-year-old child, but I say 8 to make it a pattern, where an 8 or 9-year-old child understands that a person different from them has a different understanding of the world, and they can reason about what that person knows because of what that person has been exposed to and seen in the world, and they don't make the mistake of thinking that everyone has the same model of the world as they do. If we had all those four capabilities, we would have the, you know, robots beyond my imagination.
And if this ideal robot were achieved, could the robot mature to be an older humanoid, individual through pattern recognition and repetition, as humans could?
It may. Our robot, even Baxter, does some sort of learning. But learning is such a loaded term because when human learning is so rich. So I didn't ask for the richness of human-level learning in those four capabilities. I was trying to make pretty much a robot that's a useful tool.
How much has your understanding of human behavior and the chemistry of the human body, how much have you had to enrich your understanding of those systems, even the spiritual life and the physical life of a human being, to help you in your robotic work?
During the 90s, my students and I at MIT really looked at child development a lot as inspiration for how to build the subsystems that could make up a robot that was adaptable to the world. Mm-hmm. And so that inspired us in trying to understand what software modules we needed to build to process sensory information and to control dexterous actuation.
You are considered a pioneer in the field of behavior-based robotics. And essentially, you advocate using decentralized systems to create robots rather than a centralized system. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you how it fits in the Baxter context, actually. So you could have a top-down planning system where the wanted the robot to do some task and it would plan out ahead of time every single step and then follow that plan. And a lot of traditional AI, artificial intelligence, tries to do that. Baxter has lots of little behaviors that run in parallel. So, for instance, its arms will not collide with each other. If you try to bring them close together, they'll push each other away. It knows, a little rule knows, that it can't put something down unless it has something in its hand. So it has lots of little simple rules like that, which make it adaptable to a changing environment because it's not pre-computing exactly what it's going to do ahead of time. It's reacting to what's in the environment through many, many parallel, simple little behaviors.
Why did you pioneer this shift from centralized robotics to decentralized system? What do you see as the advantage?
Well, back in the 1980s, I was looking at trying to make robots navigate around in the world, and the computations were getting more and more complex. And I looked at little insects, and little insects with just 100,000 neurons were able to fly around and do all sorts of things we couldn't make a robot do with a big mainframe computer. So I realized there had to be a different way of organizing things.
In addition to studying childhood development to better inform your work, have you also thought, you know, just on a larger scale about, like, what human beings are? Like, what is your view of human life?
So I, for a long time, I was confused by how someone could be both a scientist and be religious. It didn't make sense to me. I'm an atheist. And then I realized that in my own life, I had a duality of interpretations of the world. So if I look carefully at a person, they're a big bag of skin full of biomolecules, which operate according to rules and are predictable in a sense. But my own children, I love unconditionally. I don't treat them as bags of skin full of biomolecules. I have two different ways of being in the world. I have the scientist way and the father way. And so I realize that we all have multiple views of the world, which we use at different times, and we're actually pretty comfortable about holding mutually inconsistent sets of belief. So, yes, I think we are all robotic, chemical robots. That is what we human beings are. And, by the way, all of modern science actually believes that. It's all about van der Waals forces and things like that. But people then have a different view of humans, which can be very spiritual or very religious.
Now, you know, your view of humans being chemical robots, you know, might not sit well with some people. And I've heard you say before how it's been hard for society to some extent to accept our lack of specialness. You know, we started off thinking we were the center of the universe and the sun revolved around us. And then
God had made the earth for us because we were the peak of creation. And the one that really got it for me was Garry Kasparov. Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, the world chess champion. Garry is a very sweet guy. I met him just a few months ago. But when he was beaten by Deep Blue in the 90s, the IBM supercomputer that beat him at chess, when he was beaten, he got up and he said, well, at least it didn't enjoy beating me. Because he still had the specialness that he had emotions, but the computer didn't have emotions. So, and I realize we're always trying to be special. We want to be special.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robots, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is a professor emeritus at MIT. Incidentally, you mentioned you have children. You have four children. Are any of them in the field of robotics? What do they do?
None of my four children are in robotics, but my youngest daughter is actually an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley making engineering toys for young girls.
I want to talk about your upbringing. You grew up in Adelaide, Australia. Your father was a telephone technician, and your mother was a hairdresser. You spent some time as a child tinkering with leftover rocket equipment. Your dad was initially a telephone technician, but then he worked in a testing facility to help Europe build its first satellite launch system. Can you describe some of those early moments?
I actually had a book, the How and Why Wonder Book of Electricity, and another book, The How and Why Wonder Book of Computers and Giant Brains. And I got them when I was about 7 years old. They were American books. And they just gave a little bit enough information for me to start building simple circuits. And for some reason, I wanted to build intelligent systems. So when I was about 7 or 8, I built a computer, I called it, which was made out of nails and light bulbs out of flashlights and batteries and wires, which could play a very simple game where you took turns in taking away between 1 and 4 matches from a pile, and whoever ended up with the last match lost or won or something. And I built a circuit that could play that. And then I really worked hard. And by the time I was 12, getting a little more sophisticated switches out of old office switchboards as surplus equipment, I was able to build a computer, as I called it, which could play tic-tac-toe and not be beaten. And I wanted to build robots, but I wasn't dexterous enough to get things that could actually mechanically move. I could build circuits, but it wasn't until I was around 15 or 16 that I built my first robot.
And, you know, so you built your first simple circuit computer at 7 or 8 years old. Were your parents like, oh, that's nice, okay, come in for dinner?
Or, well, actually, it was a little weird in that. I wasn't allowed to do it during the week because I had to watch TV like a normal kid. And on the weekends, I wasn't allowed to stay out in the lab, which was in a shed in the back garden, past 5 p.m. So I had to learn how to be. I'd think all week what I was going to do on the weekend, what I was going to build, and then I'd get in there and go at it as quick as possible.
Now, you were one of four children. Did your siblings participate in this?
My older brother had a chemistry set and in the same back garden shed, but no, they were not as dedicated to this as I was. I was an anomaly. In fact, my mother finished 10th grade, my father finished 9th grade, and at age 4, everyone called me the professor because somehow I was weird from birth.
You call it weird, but did you have a sense of self and, you know, continued confidence to say, okay, I am smart? Like,
well, I could do things, mental arithmetic in my head. I don't know what it was, except by age 4, I knew that I was better at computation, mm-hmm. arithmetic, than any adult. It was just something, a gift. It was something in me.
Now, there was one computer in Adelaide, Australia, and you had exposure to it.
When I was younger, there was an IBM computer mainframe in the city that you could see through a glass wall, and I would go and look at that. Mm. By the time I got to be an undergraduate, at one of the local universities.
Flinders.
Flinders University. They had a 16 kilobyte computer with four full-time operators running it during the week, and you could punch your cards, submit them, and 24 hours later you could get your printout. But one of the professors really understood that maybe I, you know, had a lot of interest in this, and he arranged that over the weekend I was allowed to use that computer by myself for 12 hours every Sunday. So from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sundays, I had that computer with one other student, and I got to recreate and learn computer science myself. There was no computer science being taught, but I got to learn it and figure it out for myself.
Now, you are so focused on, you know, math and arithmetic and computers and artificial intelligence at the time. How about your social life, your social development? Did you have girlfriends? And
I wasn't real good with girlfriends, but I did play various sports and went to parties.
You made your way to the United States. Initially, you went to Stanford and got a PhD at Stanford. How did being in the United States change possibilities for you,
if at all? I came to Stanford in 1977. And, you know, that was sort of the blooming of Silicon Valley. And I came from somewhere where there were almost no computers. And, you know, I would be in a McDonald's and hear people talking about software and programming at the next table. It was just such a different environment. And so I really was able to get immersed. I was able to, you know, go to Xerox Park and see the Alto at the same time that Steve Jobs was seeing the Alto and the mouse and the Windows.
The Alto being the...
The Alto was the computer built at Xerox Park and was what essentially Apple copied to make the Macintosh.
And after getting your PhD at Stanford, you ended up at MIT, but it took you a few years to finally become on the faculty. And you said even despite your rejections, you just kept trying. And there's a quote you once said that rejection is not the end.
No, rejection is not the end. I did not get accepted to MIT as a graduate student. I applied for a faculty job there three times before I eventually got a faculty job. And the other rejection is I actually failed my qualifying exam at Stanford in artificial intelligence. First exam I'd ever failed in my life.
Why did you know upon taking the exam that, oh boy, I'm failing?
I did not know that. I had got there and I was full of confidence and I just wasn't ready for the qualifying exam, so I failed.
When you finally did become professor at MIT in the 1980s, you developed various robots with students in your robotics lab, and eventually you met your iRobot co-founders, Colin Angle and Helen Grainer. By the way, I was surprised to see that one of your co-founders, Helen, is a woman. How many of your students are women?
I had 27 PhD students, and I believe that 10 or 11 of them were women. So I had a lot more women in my lab than most robotics labs.
Is that ratio roughly the norm?
It really occurred because I had one woman, Anita Flynn. She had actually been at the Naval Academy, was really strong, aggressive, and new leadership. And that made it safe for other women to come in and join the lab. And then it just became a tradition that women worked in my lab and more came.
You were a faculty member at MIT for a quarter of a century. And so you kind of had this hybrid life where you were on both sides, both, you know, the academic life, but also the business world. Did that ever create conflicts within the university? Because more and more you have these professors entering business.
I was very careful to separate my two lives. So when we started iRobot, which was based on mobile robotics, I stopped doing mobile robot research and shifted to humanoid robot research because that was going to be a place that iRobot was never going to go. So my grad students would not be worried that what they were doing with me as a research project was somehow feeding into my company.
Here we are, you know, just at the beginning of the robot revolution where you saw PCs in the 1980s. Where do you see robots, let's say, 100 years from now?
I think robots are going to be pervasive, or robotic systems. Now, back in 1980, if you told people that they would have computers in their kitchens in the 1990s, they would have thought you were crazy. But instead, by the mid-1990s, there were computers, there were microprocessors in everyone's kitchen. So the robots that will appear in our world will not necessarily be the robots of science fiction or the robots of Hollywood, but robotic technology will be everywhere. So, for instance, Toyota, in their robot division, have recently announced a robot to help elderly people get into and out of bed. Doesn't look like a humanoid robot at all. It lets someone have a little more dignity and live at home longer, an elderly person, live at home longer because they can do stuff themselves with that robotic technology, which otherwise they would need people to help them get into and out of bed.
Your mother is still alive. Your father passed away. What does she think of what you've become?
She's very proud of me, but she doesn't really understand my life. In fact, most of my friends in Australia from those days don't understand the sort of life I have. You know, they'd be, what do you mean you only teach one course? Being at MIT is just a little part-time job. They didn't understand the idea of a major research university. So it's a very different life from what I came from.
Just in your practical daily life, what are your encounters with robots in your own home? That maybe have you created any for yourself to help you make cereal in the morning?
I don't have any special robots. I do have a scuba, the small scuba that cleans my bathroom floor, I was using Roombas for a while, but I must admit I have a cleaning service right now that comes in and does that. But the scuba keeps my bathroom floor very clean.
Is there anything else that you feel a pain point in your home? Like, oh, I'd love to have something that makes my bed. Or
no, I sleep in an unmade bed.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Rodney Brooks. Coming up, we'll meet Daryl Cavins, co-founder of Zulily. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Daryl Cavins, co-founder of Zulily, an e-commerce company focused on selling apparel and other products to women and their children. Zulily offers daily flash sales of boutique and leading brands at discounted prices. Zulily launched in 2009 and went public in late 2013 with a valuation of $4.5 billion. Daryl started Zulily with Mark Vadon, the founder of Blue Nile, a website that sells diamonds online. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here.
If I'm a busy mother and I'm a Zulily member, what is my experience each morning?
So what we see with our members is they're getting a push notification from us, often from an email that we're sending to them, or in many cases now, a push to their mobile phone to tell them there's new events available.
How many new products are you making available for sale each morning?
So we're launching about 6,000 new styles of product every day. Just for perspective, you know, a typical Costco store, if you were to walk into it, has about 4,000 styles of product. And so we're launching more than that every single day.
One of your investors, Ajay Chopra from Trinity Ventures,
I think,
he said that coming out each morning with new sales is analogous to the newspaper business.
Yeah.
Explain that.
We're publishing this new site at 6 a.m. Pacific every day, similar to how a newspaper might have a business, news, kind of metro sports section. We're going to have kids, home, women's, and try to have a diversity of price point and diversity of styles so that each mom coming in, there's something where she can go, wow, this is incredible every day. And I think it's that freshness that gets them to come back.
You have a very efficient cost structure because you don't hold any inventory. And when a purchase is made, the vendors ship product to you, and you consolidate and then ship the items to customers. One result of that is that the customer doesn't get his or her product right away. Why not just have the vendor ship directly to the customer so that the customer can get it faster.
Many of these vendors are used to shipping to the local boutique store or to a department store, and so they're used to shipping product on pallets. And so when you call them up and say, I need you to ship 5,000 orders today out to individual customers, it's a really challenging exercise for them, whether it's staffing or systems to be able to do that. Along with that, what we see is our customers buying multiple items from multiple different vendors. And that last mile of delivery is an incredibly expensive part of the distribution network. Mm-hmm. And so by bringing them into our centers, we're able to consolidate those items together and send the customer one package, and which at the end of the day allows us to offer lower prices.
And do you pay the vendor for the shipping?
We handle all the costs. So we send trucks to their offices to pick everything up and handle all the costs and the logistics. You know, our center in Columbus, Ohio is 700,000 square feet. Just to give you a sense of that, that's 17 acres under a roof. Each of them has over 1,000 people in them. So, you know, it's a very unique logistical challenge. You can almost think of it you can think of it more like almost a FedEx or UPS sort hub. So the product doesn't sit in the building for long, but there's a lot of activity and an incredible amount of people in motion happening in these facilities.
Are there key technologies that you've relied on to make this as seamless as possible?
Almost everything has been 100% custom built. We had worked with a couple third parties in the early days to launch the business and handle the fulfillment. I think we came to realize over time that it was a pretty hard problem. And at one point we had, you know, 6 to 7 days of trucks backlogged in the parking lot that we couldn't get through the building because the volume was coming in faster than we were able to process it. And it was one of those moments where I realized we had to bring more things in-house and do them ourselves. Mm. And so we ended up very rapidly within about a 10-week period standing up our initial Reno facility and hiring a few hundred people and putting in a warehouse management system. Things like receiving. So when you've got 6,000 new styles of product that you're selling on a daily basis, imagine being the guy on the receiving dock and boxes are coming in. You don't know what's coming in. You got to identify it amongst all those items. And so tools like visual receiving, where we take the photography and can show them what's expected to come in and have them validate that.
You're, in a way, a technology company even before being an e-commerce company, which is outward-facing, and that's what we as consumers see.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think we view ourselves as a retailer that uses a tremendous amount of technology. It's the retail pieces paired with that unique technology infrastructure underneath, under the covers.
Now, you come from a technology background.
I do.
You ran technology at a company called Blue Nile, which is an online retailer for jewelry, started by your co-founder, Mark Vadon. Mark is a billionaire from Blue Nile as well as Zulily, and he worked at Bain Consulting before Blue Nile.
I was at Blue Nile back in 1999, and the technology side of that was equally unique. I mean, we were selling diamonds and, you know, very unique products certified by third-party labs.
Can you tell me a little bit about the germ of Blue Nile? Because in a way, your companies mirror each other.
Mark started Blue Nile really throughout a personal experience. He was out looking to buy an engagement ring, and he tells the story that he walked into a Tiffany store down in San Francisco. Mark's a super analytical guy, and the salesperson said, well, which one speaks to you? And he kind of threw his hands up and left the store and said, wow, there's got to be a better way, and thought there had to be a Consumer Reports for diamonds where he could go learn what was out there. And eventually found a small site that was based up in Seattle where he ended up buying a diamond from. When he was up in Seattle then traveling for business a couple weeks later, he dropped the gentleman a note to send him to see if he could buy him a coffee and learn about his business, and walked in and said, you know, I must have been a pretty good customer for you, you know, spending a couple $1,000s. And the gentleman said, well, you know, it's pretty average. And kind of Mark, in his typical way, did the math in his head and said, wow, there's really something here. And, you know, quickly went back to the Valley, raised a little bit of money and, you know, bought this guy's business and quickly turned it into, you know, what has now become Blue Nile.
And this guy, Doug Williams, he raised $6 million to buy Doug Williams' little diamond business.
Yes.
And he disrupted the diamond business because at the time, you can't sell diamonds online.
I remember the day I walked in and told my coworkers I was leaving to go to this business, which at the time was actually called Internet Diamonds. And people thought I was absolutely crazy. You know, selling diamonds on the internet, that seems crazy.
There are certain similarities between Blue Nile and Zulily. For instance, neither of you have inventory to manage. And you both have also this scarcity component, you know, the rarity of diamonds versus the scarcity produced by time on the website.
On the inventory side, when in the early days of Blue Nile, we actually took inventory. Mm-hmm. And it was through the kind of dot-com crash when we couldn't raise more money that we kind of evolved the model a little bit to more of a consignment model where we were working with vendors and not taking inventory on directly. And that was an amazing lesson learned from a kind of capital optimization standpoint. You know, we often joke that we're children of the Depression from going through a business that had raised a tremendous amount of money to a point where the spigot had been turned off and you couldn't. And, you know, we learned how to optimize that inventory and took that lesson and have now applied it to Zulily.
What about the differences between the two businesses?
The differences between these two businesses are fairly substantial. I mean, you look at the audience, for example. Mm-hmm. Blue Nile targeted men, a high price point, very low repeat frequency of purchase. Our customer and our purchaser is almost the inverse of that of Blue Nile. We are almost entirely a female customer, low price points, high frequency of customers buying. A lot of similarities in the model, but the customer is really almost the inverse.
We were talking about Zulily is a technology company. What was so technological about Blue Nile?
I think it was in the early days of Blue Nile, this idea of having 100,000 diamonds to sort through. You've got to remember, each of those diamonds is a single one, a little more like a kind of airline seats or specific or cars where you've got, you know, these unique items that you're trying to sell. And so it's a tremendous amount of technology to make that happen and integrate with partners to understand that distributed inventory base.
So it's like a saber system for diamonds?
Behind the scenes, yeah, there's a lot of work from a kind of technology to integrate with vendors, provide them a vendor portal where they can log in and look at what do they need to ship today. The whole goal, though, was to make it simple and easy for the consumer, to take this really complex set of data and make it visual and easy to use. So things like sliders, so if you've got price points, you can narrow that down, or across a diamond, cut clarity, color, be able to go across those dimensions and understand the impact of, well, what if I spent an extra $100? What if I went down a grade on this? What if I went up a grade on this? And the number of queries is substantial that, you know, trying to mimic that experience that you get in a retail store.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daryl Cavins, co-founder of Zulily, an e-commerce company focused on mothers and children. Zulily offers daily sales of apparel, toys, and other products for the home, averaging 50% off retail prices. So going back to the early days of Zulily, talk to me more about those early weeks, months.
So as I quit my job at Microsoft, where I'd gone in between after I left Blue Nile in 08, the idea was, let's put it up there and see how customers respond. And so we went from this idea of let's do it to live in about 10 weeks. We actually didn't have a fulfillment center. We didn't have a website. You know, to see us that first day, we had $1,300 in sales, and we had a vision that we'd launch roughly one event a day. By the third day, I had pulled all the other events that we had scheduled for the next week to 10 days and launched them over the next 2 days and realized we had to get to scale much faster. And our team, you know, went through a moment of anxiety saying, well, what are we going to do on the third day? We've just taken all the product we were going to have and now we have nothing. And it's like, let's dig in and figure it out. And we worked the phones and we found vendors and we did photoshoots. So yes, we've ended up in a great spot, but the path to get there has been a little windy and a little bumpy.
You grew from 300 to 300 employees in the first 18 months. You had to switch offices four times. Your sales in the first year were $20 million, and then when you IPO'd 3 or 4 years later, they were $700 million. How did people find out about you early on?
So I'm a big believer in paid marketing. It was starting with folks like Google and going and doing search words for baby apparel and kids' dresses and products like that. It was going to portals like MSN and Yahoo and saying, we'd like to do an ad buy. But we tested into it. So it was, I remember writing those first $5,000 checks and crossing my fingers and hoping we'd get customers. And what we did is we took the couple that worked and then we wrote them $10,000 checks. And then we saw what worked and then we wrote them $20,000 checks. And so very, very deliberate and careful about the money we spent. But when we saw things working, we were quick to double down and go after that.
you've kept a very low profile until your IPO, despite, you know, you're getting traction from both the vendors and members. Why were you quiet?
So I think there are a couple reasons why we stayed so quiet. We, first off, felt like we had a great business, and we didn't want anybody to know about it.
You were worried about competitors like an Amazon or some of the other flash sales companies getting into this vertical?
Yeah, I think as we saw, what we saw out of the gates was this strength, and we felt like that we still needed to learn more about it and adjust. But you know, when you've got something good and getting to scale, you know, we thought that by getting a head start would give us a long-term advantage, and I think it has.
And you ended up raising more than $90 million in venture capital. Mark invested a first million, and then Maveron, Howard Schultz, he's the founder of Starbucks, his venture firm was a key investor very early on.
Yeah. That initial fundraising is kind of an interesting story. We went into the Maveron team, and we had a one-page Excel sheet, and then we spent about an hour and a half at the whiteboard drawing up what we were going to do. Mm-hmm. We hadn't built anything yet, and the Maveron team jumped in and said, yeah, let's do this.
Now, there's part of that is perhaps, you know, by the guy a little bit. You and Mark had been wildly successful at Blue Nile, so...
Yeah, there's certainly an element of we had been successful. What had been interesting is Maveron had actually turned us down twice at Blue Nile.
Dan Levitan.
Correct. And he turned us down twice at Blue Nile and said, I'm not going to miss this one. And, you know, took the risk with us when it was an idea and obviously turned out well for him over time.
And then fast forward 4 years, you IPO'd. Your son rang the bell at NASDAQ.
It was a pretty surreal experience to go and realize that, you know, 4 years ago when we started the business, he was two going on three, and to be standing there at NASDAQ having him ring the bell.
How old was your daughter at the time of the IPO?
She was seven.
So how come she didn't ring the bell?
So my kids, like most kids, are fairly different. And my son, who is six, is very outgoing and boisterous. And my daughter, I ended up having, even to get her to go up on stage, we had to make a slight detour by the American Girl doll store on our way home.
And your wife was with you. Her name is Siobhan.
Correct.
And you met her at Blue Nile.
I did. I met my wife through our head of customer service at Blue Nile, actually, was her roommate. I will tell you, though, dating somebody while you're working at a diamond company is a challenging thing because the expectations go up for those Christmas, holiday, birthday presents.
You're from Canada. You made your way to Seattle after college. You went to the University of Victoria, majoring in engineering?
Geography.
Majoring
of all things.
Why geography?
You know, I was, I would say I was never a terribly great student. What I found in kind of studying geography was that you had this kind of physical element, but still that scientific element that kind of excited me together. And I ended up in technology through that by spending a lot of time in kind of GIS, geographical information systems. So being able to take a physical space, physical area, and represent it in a computer, everything from where you're putting national parks to oil and gas planning, and you know, very visual things, but brought together in a scientific way.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a mechanical engineer working for the utility company up in British Columbia, and my mom was a very early math and computer science major and always had a computer around the house in the very early days of computing and just got that exposure very early.
Were they worried about you, given that you weren't the typically so-called good student?
Yes. I think, you know, as I look back, even through high school, I remember barely passing grade 11. And, you know, having a sit down with them of like, what is going on here?
Did you
drop out of university?
So you didn't graduate from university.
No.
Were you worried about you?
I tried hard. You know, I was not the slacker sitting at the back of the room goofing off in the class. I was really focused, but I just was not a great student. Memorization was not my thing. It obviously ended up working out okay, but it was a tremendous amount of work.
I think one might be surprised to hear that because you are highly analytical.
I remember in university, in college, I was taking a math class. I can remember back to the day the light bulb went off when it just started to make sense. It was actually a class on statistics, combinations, and permutations. I don't know why, but it was a moment where I realized, like, okay, I get this now.
You're one of the fortunate ones that happened to have that light bulb moment, you know, versus the millions of others who are unconventional in their learning.
Yeah, I think that unconventional learning is important. Yeah.
How has it informed, you know, your parenting?
I think it's being open to how my kids are experiencing school. And I'd say I have two very different children, you know, one who is very confident in himself and one who's a little more timid, probably more like I was as a kid, you know, trying to figure out what are the things that we can do to help help them learn in the way that is helpful for them. I've gotten to know a gentleman started an organization called Code.org in Seattle that is looking to drive computer science in schools. And my daughter came home one day talking about how she was learning computer science on paper. Actually, I was like, "This is incredible. This is," and I think, you know, seeing if there's more we can do to help there.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Daryl Cavins, co-founder of Zulily. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.